it seems like interest in using native plants and all kinds of grasses and home gardens just continues to grow. And it's no surprise, really, since they have a lot of qualities to recommend them, including the ability to deal with weather extremes quite well. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We always appreciate when Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery comes by to talk about how to use native plants and why we should appreciate them. And Neil, it's always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Judith. My pleasure to be with you again.
Always so much to talk about, and we certainly want to invite our listeners in. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment or a prairie photo. We love those on the Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Well, Neil, first, let's just kind of define what we're talking about. There are different types of plants that fit under that heading of native plants. What are some of the big kind of groupings?
Well, for the average gardener, we look at different ecosystems that they can select plants from to create gardens, meadows, woodland gardens, etc. So we have really three basic groups of plants we look at. The prairie plants, which grow in full sun to about a half a day of full sun. If you don't have at least a half a day of full sun, it's going to be difficult to grow a lot of these prairie plants. Mm-hmm. Then we have woodland plants, which, of course, grow in the shade of trees. Usually, most of your showy woodland plants will grow under hardwood trees rather than under conifers, pines, et cetera, mm-hmm. although a blend of hardwoods and pines can work. But you don't want too many of those acid pine needles.
That's the different factor.
Yeah. And the problem here, if you have a really dry, sandy soil, the selection of plants for dry sand and shade is somewhat narrow. So when you see all those beautiful trilliums and bloodroots, that's usually on a pretty rich soil like a silt loam or a sandy loam rather than a dry, sandy soil. And then we have wetland plants for people that have pond edges, stream edges, low areas. Sedge meadows mm-hmm. is the technical term, where you have a high water table and wetland plants dominate. So those are the three basic groups of plants where we utilize native plants to create gardens, habitat, low-maintenance alternatives to expensive lawns or high-maintenance plantings that would be include like annuals mm-hmm. or big perennial gardens. And you can make a beautiful perennial garden out of native plants, which will be typically lower maintenance than a more traditional perennial garden.
And as you mentioned, also really welcoming to a variety of pollinators and other wildlife.
Yes, it's amazing. Right now, it's really cool. Spring finally has come and gone. We waited forever for it, and now we're
well into summer.
It sure feels like it, doesn't it? I tell you, I was out last weekend getting, oh boy, it was hot and 85 degrees in our house. But interestingly, so many of your prairie plants are later in the season because they really do like it hot. And the peak time for the prairies usually starts around late June through August into September. But the last few weeks, and even now, you've had these glorious displays of the woodland flowers, mm-hmm. many of which are what we call spring ephemerals, meaning they come up early in spring, mostly before the leaves of the trees come out. People think these plants need shade, but most of your plants are blooming before a lot of the leaves come out. So they do like that light. Mm-hmm. And then they settle into a more shaded condition after the leaves of the trees come out. And you have a lot of early spring bloomers that are absolutely essential for some of our native pollinators.
Because a lot of other plants aren't up, and there isn't food.
Exactly. So if you're really interested in creating habitat for pollinators, you want to make sure you supply food sources for them throughout the season, which would include, if you have a wooded area, you can include a lot of wonderful woodland flowers. And then if you have a sunny area, you can create a prairie, and that will carry the show through the summer and into the fall. And if you have a wetland area, there are certain species that prefer some of the wetland plants. And especially, you don't just look at making sure you have nectar and pollen, but you want to have food plants for the larva.
Oh,
that's really important. For instance, just looking at the monarch butterfly, which is in a severe crisis right now, probably due to many factors, but one seems to be the loss of the plants that their larvae depend upon, members of the milkweed family. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people are doing now is planting specific seed mixes, gardens, et cetera, to attract and support monarchs at every phase of their life cycle. And mm-hmm. that's the important thing. You don't want to just create nectar plants. You want to make sure you've got the plants that feed the larva.
They have to get to the point where they can feed on the nectar.
Exactly. You can't have adults if you don't have babies. Right. And many, many of our native butterflies depend upon trees and shrubs for their larval stage. So this is another aspect. If you're gardening for butterflies, you want to make sure that you include trees and shrubs along with your prairie flowers. Unless you have adjacent forest land, mm-hmm. which already has this, then you've got that pretty much for free. And if you have a sunny area, you can put in a prairie and pretty much be assured you're going to get a good selection of butterflies in most cases, along with many other pollinators. And people think that there's good pollinators and bad pollinators. And oh, you know, remember, it wasn't long ago everybody was afraid of bees. Now everybody's trying to save bees.
Right, right.
Okay, I guess it's, you know, finally, that's a really good thing. The next, shall we say, frontier is for people to accept other pollinators like flies and wasps, which are completely and utterly underappreciated. And there are dozens and dozens of native species that are very important for pollinating our food crops, in fact. And what is really misunderstood are the wasps. We see one or two that sting us like yellow jackets, and we think, oh my God, they're all terrible. But there's dozens, there's hundreds of different species of parasitic wasps, which attack all the other insects.
All the real problem insects.
Exactly. Well, they're pretty equal opportunity. They take the good guys and the bad guys, but they keep everything in balance.
That sounds like a topic we should have Phil Pelletieri talk about, because we don't talk about the variety of wasps. We certainly talk about native bees and things like that and the crisis with the honeybees. But
wasps are essential to maintaining balance. I would say 95 to 98% and 99% of them never bother you because you never see them.
Wow.
They're out there just doing their job and minding their own business.
We are talking with Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, talking about all kinds of native plants. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And Neil, we often hear from listeners that they want to devote an area to native plants. Like so many undertakings, you know, it really makes sense to think it through first to get the best results. And so let's spend a little time. What should we think about, for instance, where to put a landscape, if there is an option of where we can put it? You talk about soil and slope conditions.
Yeah, I think it's important before you even embark on your planting. It's kind of like building a house. The foundation is essential, and you can put a $10 million house up, but if the foundation is no good, the whole thing will fall down. The same thing refers to your garden or your restoration or your prairie meadow. And that equivalence to the foundation is your site selection and your site preparation. So you want to make sure that you select a site that is going to be workable and make sure that you don't have huge weed problems that are going to take years to take mm-hmm. care of, or if you do, to spend the time required to eliminate and control those weeds before planting. And this is one of the most commonly shortcutted aspects, is that people don't necessarily evaluate their site conditions properly before they embark, because everybody wants to get going on their garden. I can't wait. Yes, I want to get something done. I want to do something good. But if you, number one, don't check your soil, and sometimes it really helps to test your soil, and the state has a lab in Madison and in Marshfield where you can send in soil tests, and for a very reasonable price, you can make sure that your soil does have the necessary nutrients and doesn't have some odd soil acidity or alkalinity problem, the pH. But you also want to make sure you understand the growing conditions. So if I have a dry sandy soil, I have to pick plants for dry sand. If I have a heavy clay soil, I have to pick plants for heavy clay. You can't just will the plants to grow there. It's going to be a tough row to hoe. Then the slope is really important. And I think most gardeners understand the concept of slope, or in some cases, the sides of a building, for instance. If you have a south-facing slope, of course, that's going to be very hot and dry because it's the most exposed to the sun throughout all the seasons, spring, summer, and fall. A west-facing slope is the next hottest because it gets that hot afternoon sun, and it is also desiccated by the prevailing winds which come out of the west. And when you have hot, dry conditions, that wind just dries those plants right out. So the west slope is just a little bit cooler than the south slope.
Interesting. Okay.
And of course, the north slope or north side of a house is going to be the shadier and less directly impacted by the sun. So you can grow plants that prefer less sunny conditions. And then the east side of the house is the sweet spot. Because that's where you can grow almost anybody.
That's the just right in the Goldilocks, right?
Exactly. It's the Goldilocks spot. So the east side gets enough sun to grow prairie plants, but it only gets that morning sun, which is cooler. The humidity is higher. And oftentimes you have dew on the leaves of the plants, and it takes the dew absorbs the energy of the sun to evaporate it before the leaf temperature really starts to rise and causes stress on the plant. So the east slope or the east side of a house is a wonderful place to garden because you do have such flexibility.
Should we be checking drainage too?
Drainage is really important. You're absolutely right. Yes. A lot of times it's really good to go down deep into your soil and see what's going on. Oftentimes you can tell. If you're on top of a hill, it's very unusual that you would have a problem with drainage unless you have some underground springs that sometimes do appear on hillsides. So you want to be sensitive to that. If you're in a low area and you know it gets wet, then you want to evaluate, how long does it get wet? Do I have standing water? When do I have standing water? And how long does it persist? This is very important in determining what kind of plants will grow there. And just looking at it in the summer, it doesn't tell you what's going to happen in the winter or the spring when it fills up with water for 3 weeks. It's dry in the summer, right, but that water in 3 weeks or 4 weeks in the spring can really kill a lot of plants. So you really want to evaluate a site for a year or two to really understand what's going on.
Well, and especially it seems, Neil, that because a prairie takes several years to really fully mature, you really want to start with the best soil and conditions possible, because one of the beauties of it is you're not going to be changing it every couple of years.
That's really true. Now, one of the beauties of the prairies also is that there are plants that will grow in some very difficult soils. Mm-hmm. There are native plants that will grow in really horrible sandy soil with low nutrient levels and low water holding capacity by selecting the right plants. And I always recommend that people test their sandy soils, because sometimes there's a pH issue. Sometimes you can be extremely low in phosphorus or potassium because there's no, oftentimes, very little organic matter, because that's the only thing that will hold nutrients in the sand, because you don't have silt and clay particles of any consequence or quantity. Mm-hmm. And then we have a few micronutrients that are commonly overlooked that could make the difference in plant growth and survival. And in sandy soils in Wisconsin, we often see problems with boron, manganese, sulfur, and zinc. These are four items that I usually like to test for. If I'm working on a client's soil where they have a really dry sandy soil, it's not uncommon for these to be in short supply, and it really helps to check. And never assume that you know what your soil pH
right,
is.
Right.
I tell you what, oh, there's pine trees growing here, so the soil has to be acid. Not always true. Mm-hmm. So you really want to check that, because the pH is very, very important in determining what species, because some species really need acid soil, and some species do better in alkaline soils. So it's really important. Do your homework. For a $20, $30 test, you could save hundreds of dollars of plants.
Good to know. And we will talk a little bit more about getting that spot ready, but we have folks waiting to get on with you, Neil, so let's go to the phones. Ron in Elton, Wisconsin is up first. Hi, Ron.
Hey, hello. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
I'm up here in northern Wisconsin, a little bit east of Antigo, and I have some grass that came in just wonderful in the woods this year, because we just got our leaves on our hardwoods about a week ago. So the forest floor was very exposed to the sun. And this grass, I've looked at it from the top down to try to determine if it's got the two blades across from another, or maybe a three-blade arrangement. And I seem to find examples of both, but I'm wondering what type of grass this is. It only gets about 8 inches high. It doesn't need any mowing, and it comes in so thick in the woods that weeds can't come through it. It's a miracle grass. And I wonder if I can find it and buy the seeds.
All right. Neil, what do you think?
Hang on the line, Ron. I got a couple questions for you. You there?
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. What's your overstory? What's your tree overstory? Is it oaks, maples? What kind of trees?
About 90% hard rock maple or sugar maple.
Okay. And your soil is what, sandy loam or loam?
It's real healthy. There's trilliums galore and bloodroot and ramps and all sorts of things.
Oh, man, fantastic. And is this green? Does this grass have kind of a yellowish green cast to it?
I would say no. It's a nice, vibrant green, but not yellowy.
Okay, sometimes you'll see this if it's what I think it is. The first thing you're going to want to do after we get off here is go pull one of these grasses up by the base and see if it's triangular. Are you familiar with sedges?
Okay.
Sedges?
I think that's the one that's supposed to have three blade arrangements when you look down from the top.
Precisely, and it's triangular at the base. And
okay.
I'm guessing what you have is a plant called Pennsylvania sedge. Carex, Carex, Pennsylvanica. And the geniuses that spell this spell it with one N in Pennsylvanica instead of P-E-N-N for whatever reason. It was a mistake that was made, and of course it's propagated for hundreds of years. So this is indeed a miracle sedge, not a miracle grass. And it's very common in our medium to dry woodlands. And it spreads by rhizomes to form patches. It's very difficult to grow from seed, because it produces very little seed. Like every fifth year, when it feels like it, it might make a few seeds, and you have to crawl around on your hands and knees, and then you have to break dormancy into seed, and then it grows slowly. We produce this plant by divisions, and we do offer it, and we have a good supply of it right now. And people use it as a low-maintenance grass alternative in wooded areas.
Hmm.
But it does not grow in wet soils. It only grows in well-drained loam, sandy loam, and sandy type soils.
So it sounds like Ron's actually pretty lucky to have some of that.
If you got Pennsylvania sedge and all those wildflowers, you got it made.
And Ron, maybe you should invite us up for a field trip sometime to see all those trilliums.
I still have a couple piles of snow in the woods we could play on too.
Oh dear!
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, I guess everything comes with the silver lining or the dark cloud, right? Well, Ron,
thank you very much.
Thanks so much. So, Neil, what is the difference between a grass and a sedge?
The sedges are in a completely different family. Okay. And they're in the Cyperaceae, okay, the rush family. There's a lot of rushes, bulrushes, and sedges. And the grasses are in the Graminaceae, or the Poaceae, depending on your terminology. Grasses typically have stems at the base that are either round or flat, depending on the species. And the sedges have a very distinct triangular formation, and their leaves are actually interlocked. They're like two pieces of a side. They're not actually three, but when they all interlock, they look like they're triangular. But there's actually two angled pieces of each leaf, and they all interlock to make this triangle. So when you're first learning botany, the saying is sedges have edges, because when you feel them between your fingers, you can feel the edges, whereas on grasses, you would not see that. There are a few bulrushes, like a bulrush that grows along the edges of waters, Chairmaker's bulrush.
Okay.
That is triangular too. So you think it's a sedge, but it's not. It's actually a bulrush, but they're closely related. So,
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Dan Marr tells us how to care for those fascinating succulent plants that so many of us enjoy. But right now, we are talking with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery about native landscapes, how to plan them, plant them, and take care of them. And Neil, let's go back to the phones and Lisa in Eau Claire. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question on how to protect them. I have to use a lot of that liquid fence product to keep them from getting eaten. I have a native plant and perennial combination garden. And I was wondering if you had a cheaper version or a homemade version or an alternative to use, because that gets really expensive.
This is for protecting plants from deer?
Yeah.
Lead poisoning.
Yeah, no.
I invite all my friends over to bow hunt. So. Deer are truly a scourge, and in my opinion, there are those who would disagree, but their populations are so high that they're really impacting our native vegetation significantly in certain areas. Northern Wisconsin had a tremendous deer die-off this year, which is great news for the plant world. Southern Wisconsin did not have this, and which is not great news, and they're roaming all about my countryside. So I tell you what I do. Anytime I plant a new tree on my property, I immediately fence it with a 6-foot-tall fence and stake it into the ground and put a tree guard on it to keep rodents off of it. If I do not put a 6-foot-tall fence around that tree, by the next morning, the deer will have stripped it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's completely and utterly out of control. And there are certain native plants that they absolutely adore, and they simply don't grow at my house unless I have a fence around them.
What are some of those that are especially prone to deer damage?
New England aster, smooth aster, bloodroot. Trilliums, not so much. It depends how hungry they are. But they'll just tear a lot of these plants up. And my property is a very good test plot for deer, because they roam all about and eat as they feel so desired. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they don't seem to care for the buckthorn. Or the garlic mustard. So I'm not an expert at these products that you spray on them. I use something that is a combination of rotten eggs and and cayenne pepper. And I honestly cannot think of the name of a deer away or something like
so
that.
So it's basically like sulfur and spicy.
It's putrid. And you can make your own. I know people that make their own, which I'm not about to do. And you mix this with water. It comes in a concentrate, and you dilute it, and you spray it on the plants. And it's supposed to be fairly rain fast, but I don't have time for that, I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. So I have areas where I grow woodland plants where I have a fence around them. My food garden has a 10-foot fence around it, because whitetails will, on a larger scale, they will jump a 6-foot fence, no problem. Just be glad that we don't have mule deer. They will jump a 12-foot fence.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
So are there particular plants, Lisa, that you'd like to protect and are not having any luck with?
The brown-eyed and black-eyed Susans. I'm not sure which one it is. But.
Wow.
And then Butchera.
Wow, you've got heavy deer pressure.
To cross the street.
Mm. Yeah, those are not their first choice plants either. So when they're eating those plants, you know that they're really going for stuff. Is there some way you can maybe disrupt their patterns? Because deer are creatures of habit. And if you can get them to no longer use that path, if you can create some obstructions, forcing them to go in different directions, that will help. That presupposes that they won't go somewhere else where you don't want them. But if they're on a certain path where you have a lot of plants that you like, you can put up a fence across that path on both sides or three different, four different places, and that will disrupt their patterns because they can no longer safely move through that. It's not very, it's kind of unsightly, but at least it will save your plants. That's one option.
Well, sorry we couldn't give you more positive encouragement, Lisa.
Wow. I know it's a hopeless question, but I thought I'd try.
You can put a 10-foot fence around your whole property. I wish I could do that on my 20 acres, but it's not cost effective.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa, for that call. So deer are a big problem for our native plant communities. But Neil, you also say that invasives are a big problem as well.
Oh, yes. We have all kinds of problems with invasive plants. On my property, I have a 20-acre buckthorn farm. And fortunately, it's down to about an acre now, but that took 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. And when this is the really sad thing is you cut down the buckthorn and then light gets to the ground and it all grows up to garlic mustard. So you get rid of one just to bring on the other.
Right.
But I just keep pushing and eliminating and replanting other plants which are able to fight against these guys. But it's the problem with working in a woodland, and I have prairies and woodlands. The problem with working in the woodland is that birds eat the buckthorn seeds, the honeysuckle seeds, and they perch in the trees and they poop their seeds on the ground and then up mm-hmm. on the new seedling. So you have to constantly monitor it. Now, if you have an oak savanna, you can burn that like you would burn a prairie, assuming that you have fire-resistant trees like oaks, hickories, black cherries, etc. They are able to tolerate ground fires as you would get in a woodland. And woodland fires are much less intense than a prairie fire because you have much less fuel load. So you don't get these huge 30-foot flames. You get this flames crawling across the ground that are maybe a foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't do a lot of damage to trees, but it will if you burn every other year, either in a prairie or in a woodland. That will typically kill seedlings of buckthorn, honeysuckle, and other woody plants that you don't want to invade them. Now, that means you have to have grass in your savanna because the grass is the fuel mm-hmm. that burns. And if it's all wildflowers, then you don't have any fuel to carry a fire and you just won't be able to burn it. So you have to have a grass and wildflower savanna mix in order to be successful with fire management in woodlands. But it's so much more cost effective than having to constantly patrol it, pull the little seedlings out, which is what I do on my property because I have all different kinds of planting, some mm-hmm. with grass and some without.
Right. And with the prairies, I know people often are surprised that burning a prairie is a good thing, but part of it is that the prairie plants, as we talked about earlier, come up later. So when a burn is done, it's getting rid of a lot of the bad guys before the good guys are there.
Yeah. The prairie evolved under the influence of fire. And native peoples burn these prairies as a land management tool to keep the forest out because you had better hunting on the prairie because that's where the bison and the elk and the big macro fauna that produce large quantities of steak, that's where they lived, not so much in the forest. So it was a land management decision. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these plants are associated with and accustomed to and adapted to fire. Many of our problem weeds like quackgrass, bluegrass. Bluegrass is a weed in the prairie because it comes up earlier, 4 to 6 weeks before most of your prairie flowers and grasses, mm-hmm. and it gets a head start. Clovers, etc. These are problems that burning in the spring at the right time, and the timing is very important. When the buds of the sugar maple are opening is the best time to burn a mesic prairie, which has predominantly warm season wildflowers and grasses, because most of those species of the prairie are still dormant under the soil and will be unharmed by the fire or are just emerging and are only slightly damaged, and they have the rest of the season to make it up.
Hmm.
The exception to this are dry prairies, which have many early blooming flowers like violets and pecans. If you burn them when the buds of the sugar maple are opening, that's when those flowers are in full bloom and you will do some pretty significant damage to them. So typically with a dry prairie, we will burn them in the fall. That doesn't do as much damage to cool season weeds and grasses, but because they're dry sandy soils, they typically do not have as much problem with these cool season weeds and grasses, many of which do better on richer, more mesic or medium type soils.
Talking with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery about native landscapes, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in on Garden Talk for Larry Mueller. Let's go back to the phones and Christy in Rock Falls. Hi, Christy.
Hi, I'm just calling with a testimony to the durability of red plant. A year ago on a totally hot, dry rock sand area on the south side of my house along the garage, I planted prairie smoke, side oats grandma, and red plant. The prairie smoke is fabulous. Side oats grandma did great. It looked as if the lead plant didn't make it. Lo and behold, they have leaflets on them now. Just amazing.
The lead plant, all those plants are amazing. Mm-hmm. And they each have their own strategy to grow in very hot, dry locations. The lead plant has a tap root that goes 10 feet deep or more. So, and yours is not that deep yet, but it immediately sends down a root. Not unlike the wild lupine. The wild lupine will have a 12-inch deep root after about a month after it germinates, when it has 2-inch tall leaves. So its root will be 6 times as deep as its leaves are tall. The prairie smoke is a spring bloomer, and a lot of your dry prairie plants, like we just talked about, things like the violets, the pecans, the pasque flowers, the prairie smokes bloom early when temperatures are cooler and moisture is more available in those dry soils. So they will do most of their growth in the spring, and then they kind of take the summer off, just partitioning mm-hmm. their growth. And then they'll put on some more growth in the fall and build their root systems up for the next year. And the side oats grandma is one of these very drought-tolerant prairie grasses that can go in and out of dormancy. I've seen that growing on bluffs over the Wisconsin River in about 3 to 4 inches of sandy, rocky soil on a solid piece of sandstone. And there's these little stunted side oats grandma plants growing there. And in the summer, they just go dormant. And then it rains, and 24 hours, they're like, okay, we're back.
Wow.
It's just amazing. Each plant has its own little strategy to survive oftentimes in some very challenging conditions.
Interesting. If I could share a successful deer management idea, my
sure.
sister in Eau Claire has a perennial garden, and she does bamboo stakes every 10, 15 feet and a single strand of monofilament fish line. And it seems as if the deer reach in, and they're spooked by something they can't identify, and the deer do not eat her perennials as long as she keeps that lineup.
Wow, that's great. That's fantastic.
And from the sound of it, from what Neil was saying in our earlier caller, that's a pretty easy thing to try for a really big problem that it might solve.
It's a lot easier than a 10-foot fence.
Neil's 10-foot fence idea.
When the deer started eating our garlic when it first came up out of the ground in the spring, that's when I said, this is it. Because we couldn't grow peas or beans or carrots or lettuce or spinach. They just ate everything.
Wow.
And they demolished my apple trees in the winter. I said, this is it. So that's when I put up the fence.
It puts my occasional bunny and chipmunks into perspective. Thanks for that call, Christy. Let's go next to Bill in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hey, I just built a groovy outdoor shower at my house, and the water from the shower drains onto the grass. It just goes. There's no drain, you know, formal drain. It just goes away in the grass. And I was wondering what native plants would thrive in that wet environment. And there's another little angle here is that, you know, I collect soap from hotel rooms when I travel. You know, I'm a cheap guy. And so I use that cheap soap, and what does that stuff have in it? Like phosphorus and everything to make you glow properly? I don't know, but is there a plant that would love that, you know, soapy rinse water?
All right, so Bill wants a plant to keep him company in the shower.
Bill, I got a question for you. Are you still there, Bill?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What is the sun condition of the area where you would put these plants, where they're getting all this runoff?
It faces the rising sun, faces the east, and it's under a deck. And so it gets direct sun for, I don't know, 20 minutes, and then, you know, it's shadowed by the deck, and then the sun, it's not direct sunlight all day. It's
okay.
Direct sun for maybe a couple hours in the morning.
Okay, and then it's completely covered. Is it under a deck?
It's under a deck, but the drain goes out into the sunny part. It goes out from under the deck.
Okay, so you want something. It's going to be a pretty shady spot, correct?
Yeah, I would say it's more shady than sunny.
Okay, then you're going to need some plants that will grow in moist soil in shade. Are you looking for color? Are you looking for texture? What kind of look do you want? What kind of height?
Mostly.
I'm sorry, texture moss?
I want to cover the ground, yeah.
Okay. I would suggest you try some of the sedges. We talked about Pennsylvania sedge, mm-hmm. which grows in well-drained soils. There are how tall is it from the ground to the deck? What's the maximum height of this plant?
Oh, it doesn't. No, I didn't speak clearly. It's the shower's under the deck, but the part I want to cover is out from under the deck. It's and I'm looking for kind of a ground cover, I guess. The drain goes out from under the deck. It's on the side of the house. The shower is, and it goes the water drains out the deck, and then it goes into the into the grass.
Okay. And this area where it goes in the grass, how much sun does that get? That gets to 2 hours of sun?
Yeah, it gets 2 or 3 hours, I guess. More, a little bit more than I said before. Yeah, more
okay.
than 3 hours.
Okay. There are some sedges that will grow in that condition. It's not constantly damp. It's just once a day or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Look at a plant called fox sedge, FOX. Okay. This is a plant that grows in damp soils. It can also dry out. It'll tolerate drying out. And it will grow in sun to part shade. There's another plant called Gray's sedge, Carex grayi, which has these really cool seeds on them that look kind of like maces from the Middle Ages. And that will also grow in semi-shade in damp soils. Is there ever any standing water?
Yes, it stands for maybe 15 minutes before it soaks in.
Before it soaks in, okay. What else can you put in there? If you have enough sunlight, you can grow a really beautiful plant called bottle gentian, which is pollinated exclusively by bumblebees, and it blooms late in the season. And that gets about 2 feet tall, has these beautiful, beautiful blue flowers, and that's also quite tolerant of moist soils. And it won't get too tall.
And gentian is it G-E-N-T-I-A-N?
Absolutely.
Okay.
G-E-N-T-I-A-N. And you can go to our website at www.prairienursery, and you can find all these plants on there. And there's a whole section. There's a search function where you can put in shade, moist, height, and put at whatever parameters you want, and it'll bring up the plants that would be appropriate for that situation. But I'm thinking, because of your dampness and because of your shade, I would look at some of these, those couple of those sedges, I think are going to be your best bet.
Thanks for that call, Bill. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, visiting with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and visiting with Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Neil comes by to help us with our native landscapes. And Neil, let's go back to the phone that we had someone with a shower that they wanted some plans for. And now we have Sue in Cassville, who also has some damp conditions. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. Similar to Bill, I have a little bit of property. And this part of this property is along the Mississippi River. It's prone to flood. In fact, right now it's under a pretty good amount of water. It's very shaded under maple trees, silver maples. And I was wondering what I could put in there to assist the critters on this property.
Okay, a couple questions. How long is this flooded? Has this been flooded for the last couple of months since spring?
Yeah, I would say last month and a half or so.
Okay, and does it ever dry out, or is it always underwater?
No, it will dry out. Yeah, probably another 2-3 weeks, I would assume it will dry out.
Okay.
I would say every spring it's like that.
Okay, and how deep is the water?
It can be 6 to 8 feet over flood stage, so it can be way, way over one's head.
So how deep is the water right now?
Right now, it's probably 4 to 5 feet over.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Wow. That's.
oh, boy. Not much is going to grow there. If you have 4 to 5 feet of water in shade. If it was sunny, I could say you could put in water lilies. But, I mean, that's about it. Even some of your Scirpus, some of your, well, whatever they are, they keep changing the Latin name, your bulrushes, which grow in, you know, 1 to 3 feet of water, but they need more sun and they won't grow in 5 feet. So you've got an extraordinarily challenging situation there, and maybe there's something out there that'll work, but I can't think of it off the bat what will grow in that kind of depth of water and shade.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the program.
Sorry about that, Sue, but that's, five feet of rain is quite a bit, and that it doesn't go away away.
Yeah, that's a very tough situation. Oftentimes, those areas will just dry out in the summer, and they're just open soil because nothing grows there.
Yeah.
That's not a common.
Thanks for that call, Sue. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Neil, we talked a little earlier about how to prepare and choose the right location for a native landscape. We talked about soil and slope conditions. One of the things that I think you mentioned in passing, but I think bears a little more attention, is paying attention and dealing with the existing vegetation, because other than what you just said, where a pond dries up and there's nothing, generally we're not starting from nothing.
Yes, and this is one of the most vexing problems for people that aren't botanists. Because you ask people, what's growing there? I don't know. Grass. What kind of grass? I don't know. And grasses are kind of hard to tell apart.
They're very hard, yeah.
And not every person knows each and every weed. And you need a strategic plan to get rid of the bad guys before you start planting your good guys. And if you don't know who you're up against, God help you, because you want to make sure you have full knowledge of the behavior of those species and what it's going to take to get rid of them, no matter what method you're using, whether you're using tilling or herbicides or smothering. There's many different ways to do this. But, for instance, quackgrass, a common problem in sunny areas in Wisconsin on well-drained soils. It's one of our most pervasive weeds, weedy grasses. And it has these little rhizomes that creep everywhere. And it takes a long, long time to get rid of quackgrass. And if you don't, a little half-inch length of rhizome will resprout and come back and can form a patch 2 to 3 feet wide in a year. So it's a really amazing, amazing weed. And then you have certain weeds. A lot of people use Roundup to kill weeds. And there are certain weeds that are resistant to Roundup. And there are three right off the bat that come to mind. Canada thistle. Mm. You can spray that till the cows come home. It's just like, ha, 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 you're fertilizing me with this stuff. And then you have a crown vetch. Wonderfully planted for soil stabilization, but it's a huge thug and a pest. And then you have field bindweed, which is an amazing, it's a noxious weed, federal noxious weed, and it has these little roots that if you till it, you just break it up and spread it all around and make more of them. It's very, very difficult to control. So, and all three of these will not be killed by Roundup. You have to use a broadleaf herbicide in conjunction with Roundup in order to kill them. And soil tillage is very lengthy, usually takes a couple of years. And you can't even till Canada thistle out because it has roots that can go up to 2 feet deep. And then it has lateral rhizomes underground. So you can till the top 6 inches, but they just keep coming back from those roots. And it can take you years to get rid of it using that method.
We do get calls fairly often when you're on, Neil, both from people that have a lawn that they want to turn into prairie, which you're always very encouraging of them. And then also people that might have just bought land and there was a former agricultural field that they want to dedicate to prairie. What are the particular challenges or opportunities there?
Well, lawns are really easy. Okay, as long as the lawn doesn't have all kinds of problem weeds like we just talked about, like thistles or quackgrass, et cetera. If it's a really good manicured lawn, oh, that's fantastic. We can just kill that. You can take a sod cutter if you want to do it organically. If it's a bluegrass lawn, you can take a sod cutter, cut it 2 inches deep, remove the sod, work up the ground, or fill it in with clean topsoil. Don't bring in something worse than what you already had. Okay, and I've just done it where you just take the take the sod up, till all the ground, assuming you don't have raw clay under there, and plant the prairie seed or the prairie plants right into the area below the sod where it's been removed. And typically, if it's an old lawn that's been well cared for, you won't have hardly any weeds. Hmm. So it's really, really
Well, and the turf grass forms that mat, so it actually has probably squeezed out, if it's a healthy lawn, has squeezed out a lot of the bad guys.
Exactly. So you don't have a history of the seeds in the soil and other weeds with their roots in there. So that's a very positive opportunity. An agricultural field like a corn or soybean field usually is very low in weeds, especially nowadays with Roundup Ready corn and beans. They basically blast everything into oblivion, which makes a great starting point for planting prairie seeds or whatever. And the most challenging are abandoned old farm fields where everything's just grown up to weeds for years and years. And so now you have these ensconced perennial weeds, maybe some trees and shrubs coming up and raspberries and all kinds of stuff, which are pretty invasive plants. And all the seeds that have been produced for the last 10, 15, 20 years that have dropped.
They're just
the
all laying dormant.
Exactly. So you can kill all the existing vegetation, which might take a year, but then you have all those weed seeds in there that could take forever to deal with those. So you have to have a strategy for handling that. And tilling and tilling and tilling is one way to do it organically, but it uses a lot of energy if you do an environmental impact statement. Mm-hmm. And all you're doing every time you till is bring up more weed seeds. So it's a very self-defeating process. Herbicides actually are extremely effective because not only do you kill the plants, as long as you don't till, every time you spray, if weed seeds are germinating, you're killing those weeds that come from the seeds, and you can reduce. You will never deplete, but you can reduce the level of weed seeds in the soil. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't want to use herbicides. You can use smother crops, where you come in with a crop like buckwheat, and this has very dense shade that's produced by its leaves, and you can use a buckwheat winter wheat rotation where you plant buckwheat in right about now in early June, and right when it's in bloom, you cut it down and you then plow it in, wait a couple of weeks, and plant winter wheat usually in mid-September, and then the winter wheat holds the soil over the winter. The next spring, you cut the winter wheat down when it's just starting to head out, which is usually about now. And till that in, and then plant your buckwheat again. And you do that for 2 years, you can eliminate most weeds, except for ones like Canada thistle, mm-hmm. crown
those
vetch,
really, yeah,
the really, really bad weeds. Guys. But this is the way farmers used to control quackgrass before there were herbicides, and it really works.
Wow. Great information. Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. And Neil, we talked about what a scourge deer can be for native plants and actually a lot of other plants too. So we have a couple of callers that have some suggestions. So let's take a couple of those quickly. Hey, Stella, thanks for calling.
Hi. We discovered a wonderful product for discouraging deer. It's called a scarecrow. It's a black plastic head which looks vaguely like a crow. It's on a stake that you put into the ground. You need to have access to water. You hook it up to a garden hose, and it's battery-operated electric eye. And when the beam is broken, it starts up. It goes. And then the water starts spraying. It makes the noise first, and then the water starts spraying. And the people who introduced us to it live in the woods, and they put one at each end of their house. And that summer was the first year that they were able to have any garden at all.
Wow.
And when they took it out in the fall, because you have to take it out in the fall because of the water, mm-hmm. you don't want it to freeze, they took it out in the evening, and the next morning everything was gone.
So obviously the deer were still around. It was just that was controlling it. Wow. So, Neil, it sounds like it's kind of similar to startling them with that fishing line that they run into and don't see.
Yeah, that's really great. Do you have is there a brand name for this that you're aware of, Stella?
It's called Scarecrow.
Scarecrow. Wow, that's fantastic.
Great.
And I would guess that if you Google it, you could find it. I don't know. We bought it from a store.
All right.
And they get they get trained very quickly once, you know, they get sprayed once or twice with the water, and then they'll spook and go away just at the beginning before the water starts spraying.
Wow, well that's good to know, and that fits with what you were saying, Neil, that they're creatures of habit. So if they get used to, I don't like it here because I get startled, they'll move along. Well, Stella, thank you so much for that. And Annette in Cottage Grove has another idea for controlling deer. So let's take that one before we move on to some other topics. Hi, Annette.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you about a product that my friend who lives in Marinette and plants hundreds, if not thousands, of tree seedlings every year, uses a product called Green Screen. It's a powder that comes in a little bag, and so you actually put it like on the trees at maybe 4 feet of height, and it deters the deer somehow magically. No, actually, I guess the research on it was done at the University of Michigan, and so I did my own little trial. I have a woodland garden and have lots of hosta and tulips, and this year I put the bags about, maybe 6 to 10 feet apart from each other, and I put some low to the ground to deter the rabbits, and my hosta and dogwoods and tulips have all survived.
Oh, great. Well, that's more good advice.
So those are little bags of powder, you said, Annette?
Yeah, they are.
So do you hang them or just put them on the ground?
Yeah, actually, you hang them. And like I said, at about, I've got them on the backside of many of my trees. And although if you look in my garden, you'll see that they're little white pouches. They're about maybe 3 inches tall, full of powder. And they're supposed to be good for about 3 months.
Wow, that's great. That's a lot better than most of your
distributors. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that's a lot better than most of your foliar applications, which if you get a month out of them, that's really great.
Yeah, and so there aren't a lot of distributors for this product, but my friend brought me a box of it from Marinette, and I think, though, if you Google green screen, you can see the research on it and also can find distributors for the product.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Annette. And on Facebook, Carla said, when I was in Whistler, British Columbia, I went to an organic farm and they planted lavender on the outside two rows to keep the deer out. So maybe that's a scent that deer don't like.
If you can grow lavender in Wisconsin.
Right. I've tried and it's not that easy.
Especially after winter like we just had, you can say goodbye to that lavender.
And maybe one last deer solution. Charlene on Facebook said one remedy for deer is to use 1 or 2 inches of river rock in gardens. She said that deer do not like to walk on the rock. When there are grassy areas nearby leading to the woods, rock comes in attractive shades of color and are pleasantly decorative. So there you go. It's nice to look at and does the job. Well, let's go back to the phones and Jean in Green Bay. Hi, Jean.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying the show, and I am very, where can I want to grow some milkweed plants, and I'm just, is that because it's a weed? It's considered an invasive species by plant sellers in my area. How can I start growing milkweed plants? I want to attract monarch butterflies again. I used to have many in my garden, and I don't anymore.
You can call Prairie Nursery. Just call. Our phone number is 800-476-9453. We sell milkweed seeds. We sell milkweed plants. We're starting to run out of some things because there's been a huge run on the milkweeds this year because of people concerned about creating habitat for monarchs.
People have really gotten aware of the situation.
It's so dire, and it's people. I mean, people really want to do something good. So more and more people are planting this. But we should. I think we still have some milkweed plants. We have also red milkweed, butterfly weed. There's many, many different species within the milkweed family that are great garden plants. The common milkweed, which I believe you're talking about, is considered a weed by farmers because it creeps by rhizomes. It seeds in pretty readily, and it competes with their crops. So for the farmer, it's a weed. For the monarch butterfly, it's life.
All right. And also, Jean's in Green Bay. I'm guessing that maybe the Green Bay Botanical Gardens might have an idea of local suppliers as well.
I'm sure they would. Yeah, I don't know. Not a lot of people sell it. And we're one of the few places that historically have offered this plant because, you know, people consider it a weed. But, you know, weed is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And we're into creating habitat. And so for us, what is considered a weed in an agriculture setting is a very important plant that sustains all these wonderful native butterflies, pollinators, et cetera, to us.
And Neil, give your website again, too.
Oh, yes. It's www.prairienursery. That's P-R-A-I-R-I-E. Nursery, prairienursery.com. And we're also having an open house.
Yes, I wanted to make sure we mentioned that. Go ahead and give us the details on that.
It's on Saturday, the 21st of June, and we have tours of our display gardens at 10 a.m. and at 1 p.m. And, of course, we have a retail store and all sorts of plants will be there. We'll probably have a few items on sale. We normally have a pretty big sale, but plant sales have been really good this year, so we won't have as big a sale as normal. But we will have some selected plants on sale. But it's just a great opportunity to come and see the prairie plants and the woodland plants and pick up a few plants for
and
your garden.
And ask a lot of questions and learn a lot.
I'll be there to answer questions.
Just like Garden Talk.
People bring their sketches of their gardens, and I spend whatever time is required to help people with their plants.
Great. Let's get another call in. Joanne in Babcock. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First-time caller.
Great.
I am calling because I pulled over the side of the road here. I heard the comment about lavender. I'm one of the few lucky ones. I had three survive in central Wisconsin, hot, sandy soil, of course, but mulched well. And my question was on division. Is it too late to divide in this 80-degree temperature? Should we wait for a cloudy day?
What are you dividing?
Just a lot of perennials. Gosh.
depends on the species.
Daylilies, irises. Irises, of course, are blooming, so I tend to wait till fall for them. Is it true certain plants divide better in the spring and others divide better in the fall?
Yes, it is true. Things like daylilies and iris, and you can't kill them. You can't kill them. And what was the other one you had besides the daylilies and iris? Oh, hostas. You know, it's a little late for hostas now. I wouldn't divide the hostas at this point. You want hostas, you want to get just as their buds are showing up. That allows you to see where their eyes are, or just before that. At this point, it's a little bit late. But daylilies and iris, you can dig them up and cut them back. At least cut a half of their vegetation back and then water them thoroughly. My God, I've been trying to kill daylilies on my property for years to get rid of them. I can't kill the darn things. So they're really, really resilient. But the hostas, I think it's a little bit late to be dividing them unless you really baby them. And see, they have different leaf structure. The hostas have a more broad leaf, so it's hard to cut them back, whereas irises and daylilies are monocots. So it's easy just to cut half of that leaf off and leave another half so you don't damage them too much. So you'd be okay with those two, but not the others. Some plants don't divide at all. Your taprooted plants, for instance, some of the native plants like the plants we talked about today, the lead plant, butterfly weed, there's many other of these plants that have deep taproots that allow them, lupines. People will stop along the side of the road and dig up a lupine or a butterfly weed and take it home, and of course it dies because they got 10% of the root because they dug a foot deep and the root is 10 feet deep and it's a death sentence for that plant, which is why we never suggest that people dig plants up off the side of the road.
Right.
So you want to be very knowledgeable as far as the root structure. And many of your spring blooming plants, especially your woodland plants, are much better divided in the fall because they're pre-positioned for spring because they start growth so early in spring. You get them divided in the fall. They kind of get settled in, get their roots developed a little bit in the fall. If you do this like October, you can actually, if they're dormant, you can do it in September. And then they get a little root growth in the fall, and then they come zooming up in the spring.
Neil DeBull is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Their website is prairienursery.com, and they have great information, all kinds of resources on the website, and a great catalog. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, next week on Garden Talk, we will hear about succulent plants from Dan Marr. I hope you'll join us for that. More ahead. There are so many advantages to using native plants in our home landscapes. They're well suited to our climate and soils, plus they're able to withstand pretty extreme conditions. And besides that, they create a healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife too. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses. He always has great advice to share, whether you have a few square feet or acres of prairie. Neil, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Judith.
It's always a lot of fun. And, you know, let's go back to the phones. Pam in Watertown's been waiting a little bit, so let's get to her right away. Hi, Pam.
Good morning.
Hi.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the Canada thistle. We reclaimed an old farm field, an old corn soybean field, about 15 acres, and had it planted in CRP prairie plantings. And, of course, the first two things that came up were Canada thistle and clover. And we gave up with the mowing and the spraying because it wasn't effective at all. As Neil said, they just keep coming up. You can't stay ahead of them. What we found was actually very effective was some intensive grazing with sheep. And they would go in selectively for the young thistles and the young clover plants. And then we'd pull them off of it, and then the prairie plants would come up. So there are alternative methods. You just have to be creative.
Wow.
Pam, that is brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant. And your point is that you did very selective grazing early in the season because the Canada thistles are just coming up now and your prairie grasses have not really emerged or they're just starting to poke up. So you would probably keep the sheep on for a couple of weeks?
No, actually, just even a week.
Just a week.
It just doesn't take much. You know, and then we'll go to another area and then go back if needed. But we had one section where it was probably an acre of solid thistle.
Wow.
And even just plain grass wouldn't come up. And so we finally gave up and, you know, put the sheep down there. Like I said, for about a week, pull them off, let the thistle come up again, but we never let it get headed up.
Yes.
And it's been 2 years now. It looks substantially better, and we've got helianthemum and, you know, Baptiza and just about everything coming up now, finally, because they have a chance to get a start.
You know, right. That is fantastic. And I'll tell you something else that I didn't mention, is that as a prairie matures, a tall grass prairie that has big blue stem Indian grass, because yours is a CRP, I presume it probably has.
And what
grasses.
Is CRP?
A Conservation Reserve Program.
Ah, there we go.
It's a USDA program for reclaiming farmland. Hmm. Particularly marginal farmland and putting into habitat, and prairie is one of the prime options.
Great.
For planting. What we find in prairie plantings that may be afflicted with Canada thistle in the first 5 to 10 years, usually between year 10 and 15, as the big prairie plants, especially the grasses, become established, they do eventually start to squeeze the Canada thistle out. The problem with the Canada thistle is if you don't get rid of it at the outset, it can completely take over. And the short prairie plants, if you're planting little blue stem, side oats, grandma, they are much less able to defend themselves against this because they are bunch-forming grasses, leaving room between them for the Canada thistle. But the tall grasses of big blue stem, switchgrass, are sod-forming grasses, and they are able to really compete with the Canada thistle. But it takes 10 to 15 years.
Now, would goats work too?
Goats are awesome. I've used goats to clear out woodlands that were infested, a job I did out in Pennsylvania. They were infested with more invasive plants than you can shake a stick at. We are lucky compared to southeastern Pennsylvania. But when you use goats, you have to put heavy-duty wire fencing 8 feet high around all the trees, or they will strip the bark off the trees and kill the trees. We had some nice mature trees in this woods. We had acres and acres and acres of honeysuckle and multiflora rose. I mean, it was a disaster. And those goats went in there, and we kept them in there for a couple of years, and they cleaned it out.
Wow.
And goats will eat anything. Anything. And they're cute and friendly and nice, and they taste really good,
and they
too.
Make good cheese.
They make good cheese. They make good stew. They make really good stew.
Well, there you go. Well, thanks for that suggestion, Pam. We really appreciate it. Let's go to Marvin and Judah next. Hi, Marvin.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a suggestion about for areas that are wet and shady, maybe a little bit of sun.
Mm-hmm.
The plants that grow well, if you like that type of plants, are Jack in the Pulpit.
Oh, yeah.
Your Trilliums, Bleeding Hearts. I'm trying to think of some other ones. I got the Fall Salmon Seals, the True Salmon Seals, Bloodroot Violets.
Mm.
They'll all grow in areas like that.
Really? How wet is your soil there, Marvin?
It's very lush. What's it called? It's a rich topsoil.
A rich topsoil. Yeah, but it doesn't have a high water table. Is that correct? Because a lot of those plants, the Jack in the Pulpit is excellent. That will grow in marshes practically, or really swamps in the shade. But those other plants usually will do better in kind of a better drained, rich soil where they're not actually in wet feet.
Mm-hmm.
The Trilliums don't usually like that. The Solomon Seal, they kind of revolt when they get too wet. But rich soil, yeah, absolutely.
I love Jack in the Pulpits. And are there animals, does wildlife eat those berries?
Nothing eats Jack in the Pulpit.
Really?
Because it has an acid. I can't remember the name of the acid, but it's quite toxic.
Hmm.
And so any animal with any brains will not eat it. So, and the nice thing about Jack in the Pulpit, it has those red berries in the fall. When everything else is pretty much going by the wayside, they're those brilliant red berries of the Jack in the Pulpit. And they self-sow readily. And they are very, that's a really great suggestion though, Marvin, because that is a great shade-tolerant plant for moisture. Another plant that grows in shade and pretty moist soil is the Golden Alexander.
Hmm.
It's a zizia. It's a member of the carrot family. And the zizias also are host plants for some of the swallowtail butterflies.
Oh, that's great to know. And speaking of butterflies, actually, on the Facebook page, Nicholas posted a couple of photos. One, a beautiful, primarily blue butterfly with some black edging, and said, spotted one of these in an area I have been planting lupin seeds for the last couple of years. And then there was another one in it. It's hard to tell what kind of butterfly that is. It looks like a very pale yellow, but, you know, just like you were saying, these native plants are just magnets for all kinds of wildlife.
What he's got there is a Karner blue butterfly.
Is it a Karner?
That's
I
a
was
Karner
wondering.
Blue. Yes, that's a federally endangered butterfly whose stronghold is central Wisconsin, where the lupine grows. It's the only place where you really have big populations of lupine, and it's in these dry, sandy soils. Perfect habitat for lupine because it will not grow in good soil. You give it good soil, it's just dead. It has to have horrible, nasty, dry, sandy soil in full sun to moderate shade. So the Karner blue is a federally endangered butterfly.
Yeah.
Yes, and the other other one looks like a coral hair streak. It's really hard to tell from this, but yeah. It have little orange dots on the base of the wings?
It looks like it could.
Yeah, that's probably a coral hair streak. And they're very, very common. The hair streaks are the most amazing butterflies. I'm not a butterfly expert, but there's zillions of them, and they are so beautiful. They're really small little guys, and they flit around really fast, but they are all these different beautiful colors.
Wow. Well, Nicholas, thanks so much for sharing those photos with us. And let's go back to the phones and Rita in La Crosse. Hi, Rita.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on, and thank you so much for having this expert about native plants.
Sure.
I'm so excited about native plants. I've been trying to do things on my land for 20-some years, and all the things that your guests have talked about, I've dealt with off and on. I became a widow 5 years ago, and my husband used to be my go-to guy to get things done for me, and I personally can't keep up with anything anymore. And I need help, and I don't know where to get help. I've tried hiring just local folks, and unless I'm standing right beside them, they can't tell one thing from another.
Yeah, that can be a challenge.
And so I need help hiring folks who know what they're doing. I can't find anybody to help me burn. Nobody will touch burning for me, for instance.
And you're in La Crosse.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm in West Salem.
Okay.
I own some property, and I have a lot of property, but I just want to do a little area and get it, you know, back to where I want it, and then the next year maybe do another little area.
Sure.
I'm reasonable. I just can't find any help.
All right. Well, Neil, what would you suggest for someone like Rita?
Well, this is – working with native plants is not simple like putting in a lawn or sticking some daylilies or hostas in the garden. Especially if you're creating a meadow, which is really a plant community, a prairie meadow, where you have 15, 20, 25, 35 species. And the whole process, you have to make sure you follow specific steps. And most people are not knowledgeable of native plants yet, although that's changing. More and more people are, and more professionals are becoming knowledgeable, but it's still relatively new compared to the mainstream gardening. So your options for finding people locally are relatively limited. And we offer full consulting services where we go and meet with people on their property, whether it's a backyard garden or 80 acres, whether you need a woodland assessment or how do I put in a 5-acre prairie or a 20-acre prairie or a 1/2-acre prairie. We offer those services and we install them as well. But oftentimes what we'll do is we'll work with people and I will provide them with an assessment and information and procedures and a plan, and then they may hire somebody locally rather than us go 2-3 hours because, you know, I go all over the place.
Sure.
But it's oftentimes really hard to find somebody. So I would check with local landscapers and ask them who's the local expert in native plants that does this kind of work.
And I wonder if I'm not sure who the UW Extension horticulture agent is in that area, but they might have an idea of who does native plant work.
They might too. And one of the problems you get into is like, well, we can't really recommend anybody because, because there's a liability issue. And the burning thing is really a problem. We used to do burns, but it wasn't so much the liability. You can get insurance for it. But the problem with burning is, like I say, I have clients all over the country, and if you're going to do a burn, and I have a whole crew, and we saddle up all the equipment, and we got to drag it to the site an hour, 2-3 hours, and if the wind changes or the weather changes, we have to turn around and go home because we're not going to take a chance to start a fire under adverse conditions. I can't send the client a bill for not doing anything. And it became to the point where it's just like, you know what, we can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people get into it for a while, and then they get out of it pretty fast. So,
right.
So it's a bit problematic finding people to burn. But there are companies out there that do, and I don't have a list of that. And it does change from time to time because people go in and out of that service.
Again, the UW Extension person in the area might have an idea of that.
Yes. Too. And also, a lot of people can learn to burn their on their own. And I have a little publication called How to Burn Your Prairie Safely and Have Fun Too. And it's on our website.
Great. And give that website again, Neil.
Okay, it's www.prairienursery, PRAIRIE, prairienursery.com. And there's a section on articles in our how-to section. And you scroll down in the articles and you'll see prairie management. There's tons and tons and tons of information in there.
Great.
But the how to burn your prairie safely, there's all sorts of steps you can take before you burn to make it simple, easy, and fun.
Remember, really, who doesn't like setting things
on fire? Who doesn't like
to
burn? Yeah. And besides, remember, the most important thing is don't drink the beer until after you're done, not before.
There you go. Words to live by, really. Well, good luck with that, Rita. Let's go next to Jane in Sun Prairie. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had the privilege of meeting Neil one time at his facility.
Well, there you go. Was it a good experience?
home. But he finally had to close and he kicked me out.
There you go. Well, there is that open house coming up on June 21st.
June 21st. Tours at 10 and 1.
My question, we have property in Amherst, which is near Stevens Point. And we live in Sun Prairie near Madison. And about 10 years ago, I took one trillium plant from our property, and I planted it in a kind of next to our deck in front of some basement windows where it's very shady, and I planted ferns.
Mm-hmm.
And after almost 10 years, I now have about 8 trillium plants there.
Yep.
Well, the windows need to be replaced.
Oh, okay.
Do I need to dig them up to save them?
When are you going to replace the windows? What time of year? You're not going to disturb the soil. You're just going to trample them. Is that correct, Jane?
I don't know what they're going to do, if they have to dig it out a little bit or not.
Okay.
But they're probably going to be doing this in August.
August. Okay. Well, trilliums will still be actively growing, but you're in luck. Trilliums are about the easiest plant in the world to transplant.
Yay!
I mean, it is so simple. They're a bulb.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and most plants, you don't want to transplant them while they're actively growing. Trilliums, they don't care. Now, here's how you do it. You dig up each plant, and the bulb is going to be about 6 inches deep under the soil. So you're going to want to dig about a foot deep. And you're going to want to get a ball of soil around each of those bulbs about 6 inches in diameter. Now, are they clustered together, your babies? They probably are fairly close to each other. Is that correct? Yeah. So you're going to want to lift that whole piece of soil as one unit, if you possibly can. Okay, you might need some help with this. Get a couple shovels under it and lift the whole thing up. And then you have a hole ready for wherever you're going to take them. And just slide that whole pile of soil with the trilliums in it right into the ground. Total no-brainer. You can do it when they're actively growing. The less disturbance you do to the roots, the better. On your mother trillium, same thing. Just dig down a foot deep. 8 inches, 12 inches, and about 6 inches in diameter around it, and lift that up and take it to its new home. And then water them in. They'll never skip a beat. In fact, years ago when they were expanding Highway 51 north of Madison, they cut down this beautiful woods, and they allowed people to go in and dig trilliums and all the wildflowers. We went there and dug some trilliums. We took coolers. People had coolers full of trilliums. It was the coolest. It was fantastic. They were in full bloom, which is absolutely the worst time to do this. We dug them, bare root. I had wet burlap, stuck them in layers of wet burlap in the cooler, took them right home, and that day put them in the ground, watered them in. They never skipped a beat.
Wow.
It's the easiest plant there is to transplant.
It's funny because they look so delicate. You would think that they would be very sensitive.
They are tough, tough puppies. And another thing is the trilliums, you see them all over the woods up north. You think, oh, they must be really easy to grow. They are very difficult to grow from seed because they are members of the lily family. Many members of the lily family have what we call double dormant seeds. They have to sit in the ground for two winters they germinate.
Right?
So from the time that seed hits the ground in July, it won't germinate until April, almost 2 years later, a year and 3/4 later. And then they grow so slowly. It's painfully slow. And in about 7 years, you'll have a flower.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, forever. Good luck with that, Jane. And I'm glad for you and your trilliums.
You know, that happened because when I planted it, I didn't see anything for almost 3 years.
Meaning that it didn't come up?
Yeah.
Well,
right.
You know,
and then all of a sudden it came up, and then every year I have a couple more.
Yeah. It may have been that it went through some kind of stress or something when you planted it, or maybe something ate it or whatever. But those are big bulbs, and they could go into dormancy for a while and then come back when conditions are better or whenever they feel like it, their plants.
There you go. Thanks for that call, Jane. And I wanted to point out that Cheryl, our honor producer today, put a link up to that scarecrow product that people talked about to deter deer. It has a sensor, and when the deer walk by, it shoots it with water. So it's a motion-activated sprinkler mentioned by a caller. And that's up on the website. It's Scarecrow. And also Ned on Facebook said Stone Silo Prairie Gardens in the Green Bay area is their go-to source for native plants and excellent site design. So there's another one there. Let's go back to the phones and Ron in Cleveland. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a problem. I have Dems Rocket or Hesperus in my northern hardwood forest. And I'm in my fourth year of trying to eradicate it. What it tends to do is choke everything else with all the spring ephemerals. And I've tried pulling somewhat successfully in some areas, but break off the root and it grows back. And I've tried spot nuking it with Roundup. and there's a heck of a seed bank in there. Do you have any suggestions?
And Dame's Racket, Neil, is the one that looks like a native phlox,
but it's not. Yes.
And how do you tell the difference between the two?
It's really easy. Phlox flowers have 5 petals. Dame's Racket has 4. Believe it or not, Dame's Racket is actually in the cabbage family.
Really?
Isn't that interesting? Hmm. And 2 of our most heinous, horrible weeds in our woodlands are Dame's Racket and garlic mustard, both in the cabbage family. They're nasty. And they're both biennials. And the way you prevent them from continuing to take over, pulling. I used to pull my garlic mustard. And what happens every time you pull, you disturb the soil, which just makes a new opportunity for the dormant weed seeds of the garlic mustard to germinate and come up. So last year, I went out with my little hand scy that you swing. Okay, mm-hmm. I hate weed whackers because they make a lot of noise and they stink. So I went out with my hand scy, got my exercise, and did about 1 acre of garlic mustard, cut the tops off right after they bloomed. I did a test. I did some when they were in bloom. The ones that I whacked the tops off when they were in bloom re-bloomed. But the ones that I whacked just after they completed blooming but had not yet formed viable seeds, I went back 2 weeks later and they had just evaporated like the Wicked Witch of the West, completely gone.
Really?
They died. Yes, because once, this is very typical of biennials. If this is what we use as a management tool in our prairies, like with sweet clover or Queen Anne's lace or burdock. If you whack the plants, the tops off, after they bloom, they think they've completed their life cycle, but they didn't make viable seeds, and the plant dies because a biennial dies at the end of its seed production.
Right.
This works perfectly with garlic mustard. Ron, I have not tried this with the Dame's Racket. It might work. It might not. If it's typical like other biennials, which Dame's Racket is, you may have good success with it, and that means you'll be able to cover a lot more ground because pulling is hard on the back and a lot of work. You go in there with a weed whacker or with a hand scy and just cut them so that you cut the entire seed head off after it blooms, immediately after it blooms.
Okay.
If you wait too long, it can form seed. And a lot of times, also when you pull plants that have already started to form seed, if you leave the plant attached, those nasty boogers can fill the seeds with the energy left in the plant, sitting on
their last gasp.
They're saying, I got to make my babies live, and they'll make seeds. And bingo, you can still have viable seeds that come back to haunt you.
Well, good luck with that, Ron. And I have to say, I know that Dame's Racket can be a problem, but they are actually really pretty.
And they smell good, too.
Do they?
Yeah.
I haven't even noticed.
Oh, they're
that,
wonderfully
actually.
Scented. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time hating that plant, but when it takes over all your other plants,
right,
then you got a problem.
Right. Just like you said, you know, invasive is in the eye of the beholder. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, Neil. So first, let's remind people about the open house coming up.
Yes, our open house and nursery tours is going to be on Saturday, June 21st. And our store opens at 9, and we have nursery tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. And I'll be there, and I'll be happy to answer any questions after the tours. I always hang around to answer questions, bring your sketches, designs, etc. And we'll talk about what are the best native plants for your situation. And, of course, we have plants and seeds for sale at our little greenhouse there as well.
And your website?
Website is www.prairienursery.com. Prairie, a French word, as Judith knows so well, being a very fluent French speaker. P-R-A-I-R-I-E, a word not found in English. Prairie Nursery, and of course, prairie means meadow in French. So www.prairienursery.com, and you can call us at 1-800-476-9453. And we do have a catalog, too. If you're interested in a catalog, please feel free to give us a call, and we'll be happy to send you one of our catalogs.
And actually, I just realized that Mary posted on the Facebook page the sixth annual Wild Ones Menominee River Area Chapter Native Plant Sale is on Saturday, June 14th, so no conflict with the Prairie Nursery Open House. It's at Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls, 9 to 5, and you can get more information by going to wildones.org. And again, that's the Menominee River Chapter putting on that native plant show and sale. Well, Neil, thank you so much, as always, for spending time time with us and sharing all your wisdom with us.
Judith, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Neil DeBull is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He comes by a few times a year to help us get our native plantings going and growing and so we can maintain them in a healthy way. Well, next week on Garden Talk, Dan Maurer will tell us how to care for fascinating succulent plants. And coming up this Monday at 11, we're going to learn how to organize and enjoy all of those digital photos we take. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk.